the Game. I'm Karen Given. The Littlefield is out this week. The Saints, if Saints they are, should by their presence bring the Bears to their collective knees. But if they don't, who really cares? The line all season's had it that the NFC's a dud. So be it Saints or be it Bears, each falling with a thud would come up second best against the Patriots or Colts. And people thinking otherwise would have to be prime dolts. And having said so, I'll predict the Colts for this year's winner. Though at this sort of thing, I am at best a rank beginner. Compared to Paul Attner of the Sporting News, who joins me now for some more informed football talk, even though he thought the Eagles would still be playing this weekend. Paul, welcome back to Only a Game.
You know, nobody has short memories there, do they?
We have tape. We have it on record.
I know, and my track record, I have to say, is spotty at best, but I keep hanging in there.
Well, the Indianapolis Colts host the New England Patriots in tomorrow's AFC title game. There's so much intrigue that I hardly know where to begin. Let's start with the matchup of third-string nose tackles.
That's right. Let's not.
Okay. Well, what will Peyton Manning and Tom Brady have to do to get their respective teams into the Super Bowl, and who will do a better job of that?
You know, I mean, it's a simplistic answer, but the guy who makes the least mistakes, it really comes down to who can deal with the pressure the best, who can make the best decisions, because there are going to be mistakes on both sides. I mean, both guys aren't perfect, but one of them will make fewer mistakes, and that person, quite frankly, that team, led by that quarterback, has the best chance of winning, because very few games in the playoffs are won by a team that has more turnovers than the other team. It usually just hinges on the fewest turnovers. Usually that team wins.
Have these two teams met enough times in the playoffs for this rivalry to be considered one of the all-time great ones?
Well, certainly, contemporary-wise, sure. Whether it's going to go down in history as one of the all-time great ones, I think you need a few more of them. But, you know, we still look back at the Steelers versus Oilers in the playoffs. I mean, a lot of rivalries, there's two different kinds, regular season rivalries, Cowboys, Redskins, and playoff rivalries. And playoff rivalries are spun through meeting each other a lot. And through history, it just happens that some teams have faced each other a lot. Dallas, Green Bay, another example. And ultimately, one team is better than the other, and then finally the underdog kind of prevails. It happened in all of them. And at one point, Indianapolis, is probably going to be good enough, and this could be the time.
Well, in the NFC Championship game tomorrow, the Chicago Bears will host the New Orleans Saints. Seems like a pretty good matchup to me, so why do folks like you continue to slander the NFC?
Because neither team is as good as the ones in the AFC. And the best team in football, by the way, is San Diego Chargers. They're already out of the playoffs because of New England, but they really truly have the best talent anyone in football. So we had three AFC teams that for sure are better than anybody in the NFC. Now, that's all subjective, but that's the way it's played out all season. NFC teams versus AFC teams during the regular season, a huge deficit in wins and losses, talent-wise, quarterback-wise. It's just a lot of areas where the AFC is superior. And whatever team prevails in the NFC championship game, they are not going to be as good at quarterback as the winner in the AFC. And to go back to our theme here, the quarterback is the pivotal position, and until you're better at that position, you have a hard time winning a Super Bowl.
Well, they may be inferior, but which players, Saints or Bears, should we be watching tomorrow?
The Saints are probably right now playing better football than the Bears, but the game is in Chicago, and depending on the weather and everything else, it swings it to the home team. I mean, that's why you play so hard during the season to get home field advantage. But the player to watch is two of them. One is Drew Brees, the veteran quarterback for the Saints, who has just had a phenomenal season and is the reason they score so many points in the game. And on the opposite side is Rex Grossman, the Bears quarterback, who's been up and down all year and is sometimes a self-destructing machine. So if he self-destructs in this game, which Grossman's capable of doing, I think it's going to be a pretty easy Saints win. If Grossman doesn't make a lot of mistakes, it's going to be a very close game.
Okay, as you gamely acknowledged earlier, you don't have a great track record.
We have to do this, don't we?
We do. You, last time we talked, picked Baltimore and Philadelphia in the Super Bowl. Nice one there.
Yeah, but at least I was consistent.
We'll give you another chance. Who's going to Miami?
Well, after all that buildup of Peyton Manning, I'm on record already in the Sporting News magazine this week of picking the Patriots and picking the Saints, and I'm not going to move off of that. I still think the Patriots are inside Peyton's mind, and I think they'll cause enough mistakes, and I just really like how New Orleans is playing right now. So basically I'm picking two upsets and saying that home teams are going to lose. But, I said it, and I'm going to stay with it.
So it'll be Colts and Bears then?
Well, I think that's a good bet, and that's the reason I tell people I don't bet, because you know, obviously I have a handle on all this, and I really have a great inside look. But, you know, the thing about this wonderful thing, Karen, is that these are very evenly matched games. Those are the games that football fans look forward to, because you can't really look at either game and say, oh, yeah, that team's dominant. So it's going to be, I think, a very entertaining, fun afternoon to be watching these games.
Paul Attner covers the NFL for the Sporting News. Paul, thanks again.
Hey, my pleasure.
Ten years ago, the sport known as mixed martial arts was all but knocked out of the ring. Critics blasted the no-holds-barred style of fighting, which features chokeholds, headbutts, and usually a lot of blood. But MMA is back and growing in popularity. North Country Public Radio's Brian Mann attended the recent Ultimate Fighting Championship in Las Vegas, and he has this report.
It's a few days before his December 30th title fight in Las Vegas, and light heavyweight champion Chuck Liddell is staging a public workout, rope-a-doping and shooting fake takedowns while singing to his iPod. Liddell's a compact, burly guy in his mid-30s. He looks like a cross between a biker and a college wrestler. He's not much of a singer, but he may be the most dominant mixed martial arts fighter in the country.
Give us a prediction.
I'm going to knock him out.
Reporters are curious about Liddell's impending brawl with longtime rival Tito Ortiz, but they're more eager to talk about the stunning resurgence of mixed martial arts.
A couple years ago, it wasn't to this level. Now it seems to be making its way to a more mainstream acceptance. How do you feel at being one of the pioneers, you could say, in terms of that?
I'm glad I'm still around when it's gotten big, so I'm just happy to be here. I'm having fun.
For the uninitiated, mixed martial arts, or MMA, can be tough to watch. As the name implies, the sport allows just about any combat style. There's no eye gouging or biting or crotch kicking, but it's safe to say that the rules are very flexible.
When the tie-up happens, that's when our game just begins.
That's former champion Tito Ortiz. He's the challenger in this matchup, a bleach-haired, square-faced guy who's known as a submission fighter. That means he puts opponents on the ground, choking and pummeling until they give up or pass out.
You do takedowns and kicks and knees and elbows, and there's so many different types of realms of fighting that is put into this Ultimate Fighting Championship that makes it so exciting for the fans to watch. This ain't boxing. This is a lot more exciting.
MMA enjoyed underground cachet for years. In the 90s, there were even fewer rules, no rounds, no weight limits, no gloves. When MMA first tried to go commercial, politicians were outraged. Arizona Senator John McCain described the sport as human cockfighting. Sports commissioners nationwide pulled in the welcome mat, and MMA nearly disappeared. Larry Somke with the New York State Athletic Commission, which still doesn't sanction the sport, reads from a press release issued in 1997.
Then Governor Pataki called it a Neanderthal blood sport. Speaker Sheldon Silver, who was the speaker at that time and continues to be the speaker, called Ultimate Fighting brutality and barbarism.
Fight fans were also wary. Tim Graham is a sports reporter for the Buffalo News and president of the Boxing Writers Association of America.
Boxing fans in the beginning really kept mixed martial arts at arm's length. They felt that it was a little bit too close to big-time wrestling, somewhat, you know, bastardized version of street fight.
Even with new rules and restrictions, MMA fights are usually nasty, brutal, and short. During an undercard bout before the Liddell-Ortiz main event, one fighter lies face down at the edge of the ring, apparently unconscious. His opponent pounds energetically on the back of his head. A referee intervenes eventually, and both fighters embrace before stumbling from the ring, which is surrounded by a chain-link fence. Despite this sort of jaw-dropping violence, many of MMA's former detractors have come around, convinced that this sport is a legitimate test of fighting skill. Sports writer Tim Graham has a friend, a boxing official in fact, convinced him to sit down and watch a fight.
I was blown away. I've been hooked ever since.
It's a sort of guilty pleasure, Graham says, but his change of heart also reflects MMA's surprisingly good safety record.
These guys don't seem to get as seriously hurt as you sometimes see in boxing. Yeah, there's the blood, they get cut, but in boxing, you know, even the great fighters who are known for their defense, like Muhammad Ali, you see what they're reduced to.
In fact, traditional boxers die from injuries every year, but MMA's biggest franchise, called UFC, or Ultimate Fighting Championship, has been around for a decade without a single fatality.
To be honest with you, you know, we really don't get that much scrutiny anymore.
Dana White is president and co-owner of UFC. He says his sport is outgrowing its early reputation.
A lot of the scrutiny used to come from people who weren't educated about the sport. You know, there was a lot of stereotypes and misconceptions about the sport, that these guys are just a bunch of gorillas and animals.
When the sport bottomed out in 2001, White and his partners bought UFC for just $2 million. They quickly won sanctioning from the Nevada State Athletic Commission and began rebuilding.
I think we're very NASCAR-ish in that we were a sport that nobody took serious in the beginning.
UFC is still banned in many states and has a long way to go before it can boast NASCAR-sized numbers. But the league does have a popular reality TV show, a clothing line, a video game, DVDs, and other tie-in products. Pay-per-view sales have grown with every bout, often topping 700,000 households.
Take it to the ground, Kilo!
For the Liddell Ortiz Championship bout in late December, Vegas's MGM Grand Arena is packed with young and obviously affluent fans, including Andre Agassi and Steffi Graf. This fight delivers exactly the spectacle fans pay hundreds of dollars apiece to see.
He is down. Check the Iceman. Liddell is trying to finish the fight. Liddell trying to finish Ortiz.
In the second round, Chuck Liddell uncorks a vicious knee to Tito Ortiz's head. By the third round, the fight is over, ending with a TKO. Chuck Liddell climbs on top of the chain link cage, shaking his fist at the sellout crowd. Before the match, Liddell offered this advice for people who say MMA is too barbaric.
Don't watch it if you don't want to see it. I enjoy what we do out here. I like fighting. I like most of the guys that fight. We don't consider it all that violent or whatever you want to call it. But yeah, just don't watch if you don't like it.
For Only a Game, I'm Brian Mann in Las Vegas.
I'm Karen Given. Bill Littlefield is home finding universal meaning in Tom Brady's quarterback rating. Coming up on Only a Game, Tony Galento goes up against the great Joe Louis. But first, college basketball's conference schedules are well underway. Joining me on the line to give us a mid-season look at the men's game is Pat Forty of ESPN.com. Pat, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Karen. Glad to be with you.
A couple of months ago, you said that the SEC was not only the best, but the most interesting conference in the nation. But both of those titles seem to belong to the Pac-10, which has a couple of very surprising teams in Oregon and Washington State. Or are you going to stick to your guns?
I have to backtrack. You know, when you're wrong, you got to say you're wrong. And I agree. I think the Pac-10 right now is the best conference, and they may not have some of the personalities that you have in the SEC and Big Baby Davis, who is his own lounge act, and Joakim Noah, guys like that, but the basketball being played out west right now is tremendous. Too bad half the games are ending after midnight. Thursday night I watched a very good game between USC and Arizona,
mm-hmm.
and it really underscored just the overall competitiveness in that league. As you mentioned, Oregon, Washington State, nobody saw them coming. USC could almost fit into that category as well. They're having a very good year with Tim Floyd playing in a new building. And, you know, UCLA looks to me like one of the absolute top national championship contenders. So, great year out west.
Well, the SEC does have the defending national champions and current number one in Florida. The Gators struggled with an epidemic of mono earlier this year, but apparently they've recovered nicely. Have they recovered the title of favorites as well?
You know, in my mind, they've still had that all along. I can forgive them a little bit of mono here and there as long as they're ready to play in March, and I think they will be. The one challenge they had, the big kind of prove-it game, was Ohio State, and they just destroyed Ohio State, which is a young team, and it was in Gainesville. But that looked like a team that could win a national title very easily again. And that they got five starters who work well together, who have been through all the wars together. They're very well coached, and I think when it's time to be focused and turn the screws, they're going to be very much at the top of the list and deserve to be there.
Well, you mentioned Ohio State, and Ohio State center Greg Oden was considered to be the greatest thing to hit college basketball since Hank Luzzetti and his magical one-handed shot. But the best player in the college game today might be Kevin Durant of Texas. How did Oden get all the publicity besides being the first college freshman to look like Danny Glover's older brother?
Just because he looks like he's 50 doesn't mean he is 50. No. Hey, Greg Oden deserved all the pub he got. He is as good as advertised if you consider the fact that he's playing this year, Karen, with one hand. He has no functional offensive use of his right hand. He cannot turn the wrist over to flip a shot. He can just catch the ball. He's shooting all his free throws left-handed still and making a fair percentage of them, which tells you how skilled he is for a 7-foot guy. But I saw Kevin Durant play in high school. I knew he was wonderful. I said, you know, that kid is a top-five pick, and if it weren't for Oden, we would definitely all be talking about him. He's even better than I thought. He's tremendous, wonderfully skilled, very competitive. The bigger the game, it seems like, the better he plays, and the tighter the game, the bigger the shots he makes. They had that epic triple overtime game this past week with Oklahoma State, and he was phenomenal in that one with 37 points. I think it's his third or fourth 30-plus point game in the Big 12. So he's a very special talent. He was a little bit overshadowed by Greg Oden, but not to sound like a know-it-all, but for those of us who saw him, we thought he was going to be pretty darn good.
The Big Ten is home to the aforementioned Greg Oden and his Ohio State Buckeyes, but it's also where the third-ranked Wisconsin Badgers lurk. Wisconsin is historically a team that overachieves after sneaking into the tournament. Will this team be able to handle starting March Madness with a lofty ranking?
I think they can, Karen, because they're a pretty experienced bunch, very well coached by Bo Ryan. They got a guy who might be the National Player of the Year in my mind in Alondo Tucker, very versatile forward, and they've got a very nice cast built around him. And as experienced as they are, I don't think expectations will necessarily bother them, especially the style they play. They just seem to kind of dictate the way they want to play to who they're playing, and that gives them, I think, a distinct advantage. They're hard to get out of their comfort zone. And at the rate they're going, it's not a great Big Ten. My biggest concern for them would be a lack of challenge and seasoning within the league because, outside of them and Ohio State, I don't think there are very many good teams in the Big Ten.
Last year, the Big East was one of the most talented conferences in the nation. At least it was by far the biggest. This year, the Big East has number 6, Pittsburgh, and apparently 34 mediocre teams. Can anyone rise to challenge the Panthers?
Yeah, that's a good question. I agree that it is the big mediocrity, really, this year. There's a decent second tier there. Marquette, Georgetown, we'll see about Notre Dame, Syracuse, Connecticut, West Virginia. But Pittsburgh, to me, is the best team in that group, and the big knock on Pittsburgh continues to be, until they prove otherwise, that they're nothing more than a Sweet 16 team that overachieves by playing good defense but gets overmatched in the tournament when they have to really score some points against somebody. That's been the MO for several years, both under Ben Howland and now under Jamie Dixon. This year's team could be different. They have a great low post presence in Aaron Gray. They've got a bunch of good guys around him. They can shoot the ball a little better maybe than years past, and they still play that Pittsburgh defense. But I'm going to remain one of those guys that says, prove it to me. So I say they're not a Final Four team until proven otherwise.
Pat, my enjoyment of the clamor surrounding who should be in the BCS championship game is only surpassed by the discussion of who is on the tournament bubble and whose bubble has burst. Which bubble teams will we be babbling about come March?
Well, you are talking about two of the great pastimes for college sports fans, is arguing and predicting and prognosticating about two things that we have little control over. I think Indiana's making a push and could be one of those dangerous teams. They've got some experience and a good, tough coach in Kelvin Sampson. Illinois, well-coached, but not sure about the talent level there. Tennessee looks like they could be slipping. They got tired at the end of last year. They may be getting tired earlier this year. So, we've still got, 6 weeks left of bubble mania for it to play out, and there'll be a lot of teams going up and down. But, I think that in the end-all, be-all, we're going to see probably most of the usual number of suspects from the usual conferences and maybe a couple of more in prominent positions for mid-major places.
Pat Forty covers college basketball for ESPN.com. Pat, thanks again.
You bet. Thank you.
Tony Galento was at least 50 pounds overweight. One writer described his belly as a tidal wave of mud. He trained on beer and cigars. Shortly before his fight against Joe Lewis for the heavyweight championship, Galento went fishing. Of the unlikely challenger, Joseph Moniker has written, "Galento lived as he fought, a bus wreck, a cracked window." That description is from Two Ton, One Fight, One Night, Tony Galento versus Joe Lewis. Bill Littlefield spoke with Joseph Moniker from Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire earlier this week and asked what Galento was doing in the ring against one of the most accomplished heavyweights of all time.
Well, he was, as Tex Cobb said, he was swinging leather. He probably didn't stand much of a chance, but he did win 11 fights before his matchup with Lewis. So he was the number one contender back in the day where they actually had a sort of pecking order of contenders. Mm-hmm. A number of people thought the 11 fights were fixed or at least a little bit phony, but he did deserve a chance, and enough people were behind him to push it.
What drew you to tell the story of this particular fight?
Well, I love Galento. I grew up in New Jersey, and I heard a lot about Galento growing up, and you never knew whether the stories were true, whether he fought an octopus, whether he fought a kangaroo, all these kinds of crazy things, which, in fact, it turns out were true.
We're going to get to those, yeah.
But the story I always tell about this, I was sitting on the couch with my father, and they must have been broadcasting an old fight film, and I saw Galento come onto the screen. I thought, what a silly guy. You know, how could he possibly fight Joe Lewis? And my dad cautioned me. He said, you know, keep an eye out because this guy can actually fight. And it turns out that he really could fight.
You write of one moment in that Lewis fight. Tony Galento's head snapped back like a mechanical boxer, a toy whose chin attaches to a spring and emits a wheezing sound. Did you get this impression from watching the films of the fight?
Yeah, I've watched this fight more than you would ever possibly want to watch it. But yeah, he got hit with a right hand that in all the boxing matches I've seen since or before, I've never seen a right land with such impact as that one. Mm. He was absolutely stunned. And one of the things that's remarkable about Galento is he had never been off his feet, and eventually Joe Lewis kind of knocked him down.
Tony Galento won the first round of his fight with Joe Lewis. Who was more surprised, Lewis or Galento?
Well, Galento, of course, said that he was going to win. I'm sure Lewis was a little bit surprised, and I know his ring was very, very nervous about it. One of the reasons that Lewis was reluctant to get in with Galento is Galento was a big puncher. He could swing one big punch, and if he landed, he could knock a person out, and he almost did with Lewis.
Though Galento stunned Lewis with a left in the first round, and that's perhaps a big part of the reason why he won it, an even more surprising event transpired in round three. Would you please read from the middle of page 116 of Two Ton?
Sure, be happy to. Galento's punch lifted the brown bomber from the canvas, the force sending him inches above the ring. His feet rocked back like check marks. Then Lewis crumpled. Tony's follow-through carried him halfway around, and Lewis, spinning with the force, screwed into the ground and fell backward, his left hand groping out to brace himself, his left shoulder taking the brunt of the tumble. Galento, in what would become one of several famous still photographs from the fight, shucked his hands down to his sides, opened his mouth, and stared at the fallen Lewis, and felt what it would be like to be heavyweight champion of the world.
How did you go about imagining what Tony Galento was thinking as he stood over Joe Lewis?
Well, it's an interesting question, and I know that I crossed the line or come dangerously close to crossing a couple lines in the narrative here. But this is a fight that's 75 years removed. I've done extensive interviews and tried to get an impression of Galento, and I brought some fictional techniques to it. I'm borrowing a little bit out of Norman Mailer and people like that. I wasn't interested in writing just a stereotypic sports book. I tried to do something a little bit different with it. And so I went with what I thought was probably the ongoing psychological profile of the two fighters at the time.
What happened from that point on in the fight?
Well, after Galento had knocked Lewis down, which was a big surprise. Lewis had won two heavyweight fights in the first round before this. Mm-hmm. Lewis got up and beat the stuffing out of him, essentially. He just began peppering him with the left jab that was just a wonderful jab and just knocked Galento around the ring.
There's another famous photograph taken during this fight. It shows Tony Galento slumped against the man who refereed the bout, Arthur Donovan. And of that moment, you write, "Donovan's face, stern, his attention elsewhere, exhibits pity and sadness not for Galento alone, but for effort and loss in human endeavor." I love the possibility that Arthur Donovan might have felt that way, but are we sure that's what he was thinking?
Well, come on. Print the story, not the fact. No, I do think, actually, that he might have felt that. That's what my observation was of his expression. You know, the picture is such a wonderful one, and his quiet word to the ring corner, Galento's corner, come up and get him.
Come up was and just get a, him, yeah.
Come up and get him. I mean, the guy was finished. He was completely pulverized at that moment. His nose was smashed against his face. His brow was cut. He was a completely beaten man. But he had won something in that brief exchange.
Now, after this fight, which clearly was the high point of Tony Galento's career as a professional boxer, he got into some other bouts, which you mentioned a moment ago, fought a bear, fought a kangaroo, fought an octopus. How did those fights come to be?
Well, he was, you know, Galento, of course, made some money off this fight with Lewis, but he never made a lot of money from fighting, and he was always looking for another big payday. His real desire was to have a rematch with Lewis. Mike Jacobs, who was Lewis's manager, put him off. So Galento on Joe Jacobs, this is very confusing, there are two Jacobs in the story, but Joe Jacobs said, take a fight with Max Baer, and when the time comes to fight him, don't fight him. And Mike Jacobs will have given you a lot of money, so in order to get the money back, he will put you up against Joe Lewis again. It was a very good plan, except for the sad fact that Joe Jacobs died. So that left Tony Galento holding a lot of money that he owed Mike Jacobs, and the only way to pay it back was to fight Max Baer. And he, Galento, didn't train for it or anything else, and so he went in and fought a miserable fight, and I think he stopped in 8 rounds and was beaten pretty soundly. So in between those times, he was always running off to do something. He swam against Buster Crabb. He batted against Bob Feller. And he got in the ring with Tony Baer that he traveled around with. It's hard to know at this point how much of it was real and how much of it was just show. But he loved to put on a show, and he was willing to do different things in order to get the public to pay attention. One of my favorite things is that he spent a brief time in vaudeville wearing a kind of leotard, dancing around with a ball, an orb, and then turning around periodically and punching a Joe Lewis doll. I mean, there were horrible, horrible things they got him to do in order to keep himself in the public attention.
Grim as the picture is, I can visualize Tony Galento fighting a kangaroo, a bear, you know, whatever. But to visualize him fighting an octopus, you're going to have to give me some help with that one.
Well, the story that I've heard about this, he was done pretty much with boxing. He was engaged in a wrestling career, and the wrestling, as it is today, was somewhat suspect. And he was out in Seattle, I believe it was, and his manager was down in the bar talking to one of the arena owners. And the arena owner said, well, I think we should put Tony in against an octopus. So the manager, he woke Tony up, and Tony sort of came out of a drunken reverie and said, well, sure, I'll do it. So the next day...
Shouldn't even laugh.
I know. So the next day, Galento shows up to the auditorium, and there's this enormous aquarium filled with seawater and an octopus with the head that looks like a deflated basketball floating in the middle of the ring. And, of course, nobody knew until that point, and probably Tony Galento didn't know until that point, that he's terrified of an octopus too. So Ginsburg pushes him up the stairs, and Galento's in a bathing suit, and he splashes into the aquarium, and the octopus lets loose its defensive ink, and the whole aquarium turns black. And what happens next is anybody's guess. There are different stories about it. But Galento is in. There's thrashing around in the water. People are screaming and yelling, and apparently the octopus suffers either a fatal injury or some sort of injury. Galento comes shooting out of the water and pushes Ginsburg down the ladder and escapes.
Now, Tony Galento is memorialized in Bartlett's quotations, of course. He's in there for saying, Almoida da bum. He said it on any number of occasions. I don't know whether he said it about the octopus. But how is he remembered by boxing historians?
Well, he's a bit of a footnote. I don't think many people have given him much thought. I took a trip up to the Boxing Hall of Fame a couple summers ago, and I spoke to a couple people there, and I said, does he stand a chance to get into the Hall of Fame? And as a pure boxer, I don't know that he'll ever receive that kind of recognition. But people who remember him as kind of emblematic of a certain time and a place, a time when people fought two or three times, a time when fighting was a vehicle for people who were perhaps on a lower rung of society, used as a means to take a step up. So in that sense, he will be remembered, I think.
Joseph Monagher is the author of Two Ton, One Fight, One Night, Tony Galento versus Joe Lewis, published by Steerforth Press. He joined Bill Littlefield from Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire, earlier this week. We'll be right back.
Smith.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com.
I'm Karen Given. Bill Littlefield is at home suffering from Super Bowl fever. Ahead on Only a Game, the high school bowling craze strikes an Illinois suburb and spares few. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. He joins me from NPR in Washington. What's up in the nation's capital, Charlie?
The sun is up in the nation's capital.
Wow, that's awesome.
I'm not sure anyone else is, but the sun is.
Will New England beat Indianapolis tomorrow, no matter how poorly the Patriots play?
No matter how poorly the Patriots play. But I have a feeling the Patriots have their one bad game out of their system last week against the San Diego team. And I look at Indianapolis, I see a defense that literally couldn't tackle anybody 4 weeks ago, all of a sudden acting like wild beasts of the jungle, and I don't trust them. And I don't think that defense is all it's been cracked up to be in the first two games. And I think New England will win.
So who will win the NFC?
I think that New Orleans simply has too much offense for the Bears, and I think the Rex Grossman experiment is still a dubious one, and I think that'll be enough to send New Orleans to Miami.
Despite some weird decisions last Sunday, Marty Schottenheimer remains the coach of the San Diego Chargers. Not only that, he turned down the team's offer of a $4.5 million extension through 2008. Why?
That I don't know, unless he thinks he can get a better deal somewhere else. It's impossible, even in the National Football League, to fire a guy who's 14-2. So I think he may be thinking a few moves ahead on the chessboard. There may be another job out there that he wants.
Michael Vick's water bottle was confiscated Wednesday at Miami International Airport because it allegedly smelled like marijuana. Vick was apparently reluctant to toss the bottle. Shouldn't he have known better?
Well, that's the whole thing. I mean, if you're going to smuggle your alleged dope, don't smuggle in things you know they're throwing out on airplanes. This is like keeping it in your shoe or keeping it in your metal money clip. You know people are going to look at it. Although I'm glad that this week the Transportation Safety Administration managed to catch Michael Vick, but also at the same time managed to let a 9-year-old kid get on an airplane and fly.
On November 20th, former NFL defensive back Andre Waters committed suicide. This week, a forensic pathologist concluded that concussions the player suffered during his NFL career contributed to his depression and his death. Will this finding accelerate the league's investigation into the welfare of retired players?
Well, not only that, it should accelerate the league's protection of its players against repeated concussions. This is an area I, unfortunately, from personal experience, know something about. If you have a series of concussions, you are at a dramatically increased risk of Alzheimer's disease or symptoms resembling Alzheimer's disease, which is what Andre Waters had. This is not disputable. This is scientific fact. And players who can't accept this fact and players who can't act on this information should be made to act on it by their teams.
The National Football League announced this week that the first regular season game to be played outside the U.S. will occur in London next fall. Do you suppose ads there will refer to the game as football?
I think you'll probably see American football. I don't think you'll see football, and you certainly won't see professional football. You'll see American football, and maybe it will be treated as a curiosity, which might be good for all concerned.
Regarding pro basketball, my candidate for the week's least likely headline is Kwame Brown won't be prosecuted in cake heist. Isn't Brown making enough money to afford his own quality baked goods?
Absolutely. Go out and buy yourself a nice hostess, Kwame.
The Detroit Pistons got Chauncey Billups back on Wednesday. They suited up former Philadelphia 76er Chris Webber on the same night, which constituted a homecoming of sorts for the power forward. Detroit lost to Utah, but will the Pistons be better for the rest of the season?
It depends completely on whether or not Chris Webber can stay healthy for the rest of the season. If he goes there, doesn't try to do too much, is happy about being at home where he played his well-remunerated college ball, he will make them a better team.
In the "with friends like these, who needs enemies" category, Barry Bonds announced this week that he thinks Pete Rose and Mark McGwire belong in the Hall of Fame. What is Bonds' interest in this matter?
Well, I think he's saying that we ought to overlook things like off-the-field pharmaceutics and gaming practices and let people in on the basis of their records. I think he's developing the libertarian rule-breaker lobby in the Hall of Fame voting.
Elsewhere in baseball, the Colorado Rockies are instituting Faith Days at Coors Field. Greg Fiesel, a senior vice president with the Rockies, said this week that the occasion will be no different from Alumni Night or Scout Days. What do you think?
I think that he's being incredibly disingenuous. This will not be Faith Days. This will be a specific form of fringe Christianity that will be celebrated, which is already celebrated in far too many places in Colorado. And I think to use it as this kind of cynical marketing ploy to relieve suckers of their money is beneath contempt.
Muhammad Ali turns 65 this week, and it was announced that he is lending his name, his image, and his reputation to a snack food company called GOAT, an acronym for Greatest of All Time. The snacks have names such as Rumble, Shuffle, and one of the flavors is Thrilladilla. Shouldn't that have been Thrilla in Vanilla?
I guess not, and I guess you don't buy these things in manila envelopes. But I do like the GOAT. I think they just call them GOAT. I think they should be asked to buy a GOAT bar.
NASCAR is apparently trying to excite Bill's demographic, Charlie. The guy who was NASCAR's Rookie of the Year when Bill graduated from high school is attempting a comeback. How do you like 72-year-old James Hilton's chances?
First of all, Bill's sick. Let's not do bad things to Bill on his own radio program while he's sick. Second of all, I can hardly wait till this guy's triumph in what I'm sure is going to be the upcoming Old Country Buffet 500.
Ryan Dott, a graduate student at Penn State University, took his winter break at the Poker Stars Caribbean Adventure Tournament in the Bahamas and returned to campus with $1,500,000. That's a lot of kegs.
I was about to say, when I think of what I could have spent $1 million on in my junior year, for example, in college, I'm pretty safe in assuming that I would not have had a senior year in college.
And finally, Charlie, do you know that there is a pillow fight league in Toronto?
No, but I'm not surprised in the least. Why don't you tell me about it?
Well, it features athletes with pseudonyms like Linsomnia and Sarah Bellum. Do you think the sport is too fluffy to make a hit with fans?
I think it's an extreme sport for people who aren't very extreme.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine. He's rooting for the Patriots again this weekend for some reason. He joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website, onlyagame.org. Today, at a bowling alley 25 miles southwest of Chicago, the Victor J. Andrew High School bowling team will be taking another step towards history. The team is competing in sectionals today against 13 other high schools for a chance to return to the state tournament later this month. It might not be a big deal for most Andrew students, but it is for the bowlers. They are winners of the last two Illinois state bowling titles, an impressive feat seeing as the Illinois High School Association has only been awarding titles since 2003. Is a three-peat possible? Coach Mike Murphy thinks so. In the suburbs of Chicago, he's building a bowling dynasty. Only a Game's Keith O'Brien has this story.
Mike Murphy, tall and lanky, walks from lane to lane at a recent practice at Orland Bowl in Orland Park, Illinois, not far from Andrew High School. At 69 years old, he says his knees are going, arthritis setting in. But with a bowling ball in hand, Murphy, 6'2", moves with ease. He slips off his Chicago Bears jacket and goes to work, teaching the Andrew High School Thunderbolts how to pick up spares, stay behind the ball, and avoid the dreaded hook.
Close. Yeah, you're still turning a ball, you know, and against a 10 pin, which you don't want to do. Can you throw the ball with one finger out?
This?
Yeah.
Like this?
Like that.
Yeah.
Can you?
I try.
I want to see you shoot a 10 pin like that.
The boys listen to Murphy. This is his game, his team, and he has the hardware to prove that he knows what he's doing. In the autumn of his life, the retired computer technician is a two-time back-to-back state champion. In the state of Illinois, 760 high schools offer football, and just 139 offer boys bowling. But according to the United States Bowling Congress, bowling is the fastest-growing high school sport, with varsity programs now in 18 states. And it's certainly growing at Andrew. More and more kids are signing up to bowl, while the coach marvels at what his teams have accomplished.
I keep going back through the scrapbook that my wife put together, you know, just to make sure that it really did happen. I'm 69 years old, and this is one of the highlights of my life. Now, maybe I led a boring life. I don't think so. But I really enjoy working with kids.
On a recent morning at Andrew High School, students peel through the hallways, heading off to class. The school is located in Tinley Park, about 30 miles southwest of Chicago, just off Interstate 57. The landscape is flat, Midwestern. Roughly 2,600 kids attend Andrew High, playing 31 sports, and the school's Wall of Fame almost fills an entire hallway.
The first student of the Wall of Fame is over here.
Rich Piacek, the school's athletic director, stands before the old photographs, some yellowing with time. There are baseball players, football players, cross-country runners, and wrestlers on the wall.
You see the old black and white picture from 78 was the first student that made the Wall of Fame. Then every year since then, we redid this about 3 years ago in our construction to uniform it, make it all 8x10s. Kids really like it. The alumni love it.
Soon, Piacek says, there will even be at least one bowler. A surprising development, seeing as boys bowling wasn't even a sanctioned high school sport until recently.
Actually, about 5 or 6 years ago, we had an eighth grade open house, and a parent came up to me and said, are we going to start boys bowling? I said, well, there really isn't any push. And she goes, well, my son's a good bowler, and I'd love to have him involved in high school sports and bowling. And at that time, high school bowling boys wasn't recognized as a high school sport.
Piacek says that in his day, kids weren't even allowed to go into bowling alleys. They were considered on par with pool halls, dark, smoky, and dangerous. But that has now changed. With bowling programs more common across the U.S., Illinois held its first boys bowling state tournament in 2003. Andrew High School formed a club team that year and a varsity team the next. No one expected they would do very well, and no one really cared either. That's why everyone was shocked in 2005 when they won the state title, beating the defending champs by a handful of pins.
It was the best feeling I've ever had in my life.
Two-time state champ Ryan Tracy.
It was amazing. I mean, we knew we had a good team going in, but we didn't know that we actually had a shot to win. We actually shot really well, and we just squeaked by 14 pins.
It was considered by some to be a fluke. But last year, Murphy's team had another great season, winning the sectional title and returning to Southern Illinois for the state tournament. And this time, the Thunderbolts didn't just win. They set a scoring record by totaling 13,151 points in 2 days of bowling. For the second year in a row, Andrew High School held a school-wide assembly to honor the bowlers. Murphy was there and recalls the feeling.
Phenomenal. You put 3,000 kids in a gymnasium screaming and shouting. That's like nothing you've ever seen before in your life. The first year, our athletic director let me introduce the team. And my voice was fine. It wasn't cracking and it wasn't breaking it, but I was holding a piece of paper in my hand, and he said the paper was going like this throughout the whole thing. I was unaware of it. So last year he did the introductions.
You were nervous.
I guess I was. I can't deny it because they've got it on film.
Starting today, Andrew High School will try to do it all over again. After finishing 5-1 in conference this season and 7-4 overall, they must finish first or second at the sectional tournament today to earn the right to go back downstate and defend their title. It could happen, Murphy says, but it will be harder this year. 4 of the Thunderbolts' 5 starters graduated in 2006. If they return to the state tournament, it will be as a less experienced team and also less consistent. Their up-and-down play this season has had Murphy pulling out the gray hair on his head, but their coach is not giving up on them.
I know they tried to do something where you slept and you, during sleep, you were fed pictures of perfect strikes and perfect approaches and things like that, and it, I guess it never worked out. But they tell you that now in your mind when you're on the approach, just think about a perfect shot. Just think about a perfect shot. That's all you have to think about. If you can get to that stage, you know, you'll be on tour. You'll be on tour.
Sometimes Murphy wonders if maybe he could have made it on tour. As a young man growing up on the north side of Chicago, he had the skills and the drive. He has bowled more than a dozen perfect games in his life, and even now, as he complains about getting old, he bowls all the time. But Murphy does not think much about the past, what might have been. He'll take this team, this chance, right now.
Okay, sir, on three. Ready? One, two, three. Good job.
After a recent practice at Orland Bowl, the school photographer moves in to snap pictures. They are for the yearbook, for the kids, and maybe one day, if they're lucky, a wall at Andrew High School. A few may even end up in Murphy's scrapbook. He doesn't have much time left at Andrew. He'll coach one more season, he says, and then he's planning to spend his winters down south.
I'll miss it. I really will miss it. The kids that I've come in contact with, well, you read a lot of stories about kids today, you know, but I've never met a bad one. They're a joy to work with, a joy to be with. I'm going to be leaving some things behind, I hope, but it continues. I hope we have the same success.
But whether the team will keep winning once he's gone, Murphy will always have this time to remember. A time when the most successful athletes in town were bowlers.
Okay, first row, I want your hands on your thighs. Second row, I want your hands behind your back. Back row, hands behind your back.
For only a game, I'm Keith O'Brien in Tinley Park, Illinois.
Here we go, looking right here. One.
So many people live and make believe. They keep a lot of dirt up their sleeve. But my love, baby, isn't the kind that fools. Come on, baby, let the good times roll. Hey, hey, let the good times roll.
Only a Game is produced by Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Genevieve Haas at Dartmouth College. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about Two-Ton, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. In our final word, we check in with Bill Littlefield as he convalesces at home. I don't know what bug he has, but it sure sounds like a good one. I'm Karen Given. Thanks for listening. Bill will be back next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at BreakthroughCollaborative.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning at DigitalLearning.MacFound.org.